Hi, this is Alan Chartok. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with playwright and author Ronnie Cohen. First and foremost, Ronnie Cohen is a writer. She has written 4 plays, 1 musical, 2 television pilots, and a feature film, and she has just completed the first draft of a novel tentatively titled Cover Story. Ronnie Cohen started as an advertising copywriter and spent over 30 years in the advertising business in Los Angeles, Boston, and Geneva, Switzerland, before she returned to writing plays, her first love, in 2002, often with her dear friend and co-writer, Jane Beale. Their first play, Correction, was a finalist in the Siena College International Playwrights Competition. It also won a Beverly Hills Festival Award. Ronnie's other plays include Dogs Lie, The Street, Witnessed by the World, and Blood in the Street. Her writing career took a turn when she began research for Witnessed by the World, a play about the assassination of JFK. Witnessed ran for 5 weeks in New York City in the fall of 2013, in time for the 50th anniversary of the assassination, and has led Ronnie and Jane to their latest play, Blood in the Street, about the role of Sirhan Sirhan in the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Currently, Ronnie is working on a novel about a struggling magazine publisher who gets a chance to expose the truth about the Kennedy assassination and aftermath called Cover Story. We'll talk with Ronnie Cohen about all of this and more, but first, welcome, Ronnie Cohen.
Hi, Alan.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're talking to us about all of this. I would say there's a modicum of controversialness about what you say.
Probably. You know, while I'm a playwright and I spent about 12 years and counting on some of this research, there are scholars and authors and researchers who've spent their careers, actually, looking into these mysteries.
Where were you born?
Like lots of people, in Brooklyn, where my son actually lives right now in Bushwick. And I went to college first in Syracuse in New York and then Hofstra on Long Island. And then traveled around the country doing advertising for a while until I got back to New York in the 90s. Happy to be back.
Is it hard to make a living being a playwright?
It's impossible, actually, unless, of course, you're Neil Simon or somebody like that. Yeah. No, I still have a day job myself.
What is it?
I'm actually an investment banker, but the good kind, Alan. Yeah, the good kind. You know, I graduated after 30 years in the ad business and became somebody who puts small ad agencies together with large guys. So I'm sort of a broker in the ad biz.
So what do you have to say about Deutsche Bank and the goings-on in which they discover something unusual about the Trump finances and their bosses refuse to let them go forward and get in touch with the right federal authorities?
You know, you bring up a really interesting point because for investment bankers, we're often in an organization called FINRA, which is run by the Treasury, the SEC, and you are so, it's drilled into you periodically, like, that you must, absolutely must report any of these suspicious amounts of transfer to foreign nations or anything you might find that is suspicious, and they'll take it from there. So, I don't know, you know, I don't know enough about Deutsche Bank. I do know that it's not surprising to hear about them. There have been problems with that bank for a while, and their association with the Trump organization is pretty well known. But it's amazing to me that they fired this poor woman. That was incredible.
Yeah, well, it was also a little stupid, I think. I mean, you know, why not just give her a little extra money and say goodbye?
Yeah, just push her off to the side someplace.
Right.
I know.
Oh, there's always different sides to a story. But most banks, I just want to hold you on to this because I know we have a great deal more to talk to, but most banks, right, Ronnie, take these reporting responsibilities serious, don't they?
Yeah. It's so easy to be fined. It's so easy to step over the line. And there are all of these compliance departments, huge departments within these banks that do nothing but that, making sure everybody's following all the rules.
Wow. Okay. So, of course, one of the things that I found so interesting when I first talked to you, just person to person, was the idea that you had become very interested in the Kennedy assassinations. I know that the latest work is on Robert Kennedy and the allegation that Sirhan Sirhan did it by himself. But there are those who have deep questions, and I take it you're one of them.
Absolutely, yeah. It's interesting to talk about Robert's assassination vis-a-vis JFK because in the JFK story, there's, you know, thousands of people who've looked into it. With Robert, it's really just a handful. And that's perplexing because Sirhan, the perpetrator of the deed is still in jail. And you would think that it would, you know, have more attention taken to it. But, you know, I think in order to really talk about this, we need to remember what was going on in 1968 and talk about the times a little bit. And I'd like to start with Allard Lowenstein. Does that name ring a bell to you, Alan?
Hey, I'm a West Sider. What are you talking about?
So back in like 67, Allard Lowenstein was a real anti-war guy. And I was following this pretty closely because he was my congressman on Long Island. And I actually, one year, worked for his reelection stuffing envelopes when people did things like stuff envelopes to get elected. And Allard went to Robert Kennedy and asked him to run as the anti-war candidate against Lyndon Johnson for a reelection. And Robert Kennedy said no. So Allard then got Eugene McCarthy, of course, another name I know you know. And he started on the path for a presidential run as the anti-war candidate. And he was doing pretty well. He was getting some support. And then when he kind of won the New Hampshire primary, or did well enough to get the attention back of Robert Kennedy, Robert called Allard Lowenstein back and said, okay, I'm in.
Yeah.
You remember that?
I do indeed. And it also goes to the fundamental question of the character of Bobby Kennedy.
You got it. And as a kid, you know, following Eugene McCarthy and wanting the war over, I really did not like Robert Kennedy. I mean, I thought he was arrogant. He was kind of a usurper, you know, a carpetbagger last minute, displacing poor Eugene McCarthy. And while he had, you know, and he was sort of on the coattails of his brother. I don't know. I just had,
and let's remember a few other things there, Ronnie Cohn. He worked for Roy Cohn and for the McCarthy Committee. You know, pretty amazing. A lot of people have been willing to forgive and forget all of that. And we have a bridge, a major bridge named after him.
Yeah. Well, Alan, you know, you and I enter the story in the same place, but I changed my tune because I, in researching him for the play, saw a lot of what he did do that was fantastic. He was a major civil rights guy. He was a major supporter of the unions. You remember Cesar Chavez and the grape pickers and the farm workers.
Yes.
And he wrote some amazing speeches. So I kind of became much more in his camp than I had been before I got into it. So the picture is now he's running. He's going to be the president, you know, candidate. Johnson, you know, says he's not running. So it's really going to be him against Nixon. And he wins the big California primary, a very important primary. It's June 1968. He makes the speech in the Ambassador Hotel, jam full of, you know, admirers and reporters, and is on his way to a press conference through the kitchen of the Ambassador when Sirhan Sirhan, in front of 70 witnesses, shoots him and kills him. Although, here's the rub. So, forensic evidence and ballistics suggest that there was more than one gunman in the kitchen that night.
What is that forensic evidence?
I'm going to give it to you right here. So,
okay, go ahead.
The bullet that kills Robert Kennedy is shot from behind his left ear close enough to leave powder burns on his neck. Do you remember the name Thomas Noguchi, the coroner? Yes, from the O.J. Remember O.J.'s trial? Thomas Noguchi writes a report. He's the pathologist that says the gunshot comes from the back, the rear, while everybody, including all the photos of the time, show Sirhan is firing in front of Robert Kennedy. He's a couple of feet in front of him. He's brought down by Rosie Grier. Remember, he tackles him on the table and wrestles the gun away, et cetera, et cetera. There are witnesses all over the place that say they saw other people that were suspicious in the kitchen. The gun that Sirhan has 8 bullets in its chamber, you know, can shoot 8 bullets. Well, people don't remember that besides Robert Kennedy, there were 5 other victims in the kitchen that day. There were 5 other innocent bystanders, if you will, that were shot by Sirhan, who was shooting wildly all over the place. In fact, there are gun residues in the ceiling. There are holes in the door jamb. There's stuff all over. It's mayhem in the kitchen. One of the bystanders who was seriously shot was Paul Schrade. And Paul Schrade was a Kennedy aide, and he had been standing right next to him. And he was a union organizer. He was a very important person in this story. He gets very seriously injured in his head, and it takes him a couple of years, actually, to recover. The other kind of shots were much more superficial, except for Robert Kennedy, who, as I explained, is killed by a shot from the rear. So other people, you know, said they heard a lot more shots and all of that. The cops were easy to just sort of dismiss all that. But after the Freedom of Information Act allowed the files to be reopened, it was seen in the FBI documents of the time that they, too, found 13 bullets at the scene. So it wasn't just, obviously, one gun. It was somebody else or more than one other person shooting in the kitchen that night. Also, in the Freedom of Information Act files that were uncovered in L.A., there was a reporter from CNN called Brad Johnson. And Brad was going through those files and found a cassette. The cassette was recorded by a very young guy named Przinsky, and he was a reporter. Maybe even it was for like a college newspaper, I can't recall. And he had been recording Robert's, you know, acceptance speech in the auditorium and inadvertently kept the recorder going and went, followed, you know, the crowd from the big room into the ante room in the kitchen and was still recording all this ambient noise and conversations, whatever, whatever. And then you hear shots being expelled in the kitchen, and he's got this all on tape. So Brad Johnson, now a fast forward, we're now in the 21st century. He finds an audiophile, a guy who's an expert in sound, to evaluate the tape, the cassette. And this guy, Von Prague, finds 13 shots that he can identify using his equipment. And not only are they the same 13 bullets that I just told you about, they're coming from different directions. So some are coming east to west. The others sound like they're coming west to east. And there are a couple of times when the bullets are so close together, it's like that they had to have been expelled by different guns. Like a gun doesn't, you know, shoot that quickly. So there's so much evidence that there was another gunman in the kitchen that day. There were witnesses who testified and found that later on when they saw their documents that they had been altered. This one woman, Nina, said she heard the 13 shots or 12 or 13 shots. And in the document, it says she heard 8. So you can kind of find that if you Google around CNN, April 30th of 2012, you can find some of that information. But my, you know, take on that is net-net, between the forensics and the ballistics, there was more than one gunman in the kitchen that day.
Okay, a couple of questions. Let's talk about Sirhan for a moment. What does he have to say about all this?
Well, it's so interesting because Sirhan, you remember he was from Palestine. He was he immigrated with his family. I would say in today's world, we might have called him a slacker. He was a real easygoing guy who had a lot of odd jobs. He wanted to be a jockey. He was small and thin, and he had aspirations to be a jockey, and he got a job walking horses and started hanging out at Santa Anita Raceway. While he was a non-political guy, he might have made some interesting friends there. But at any rate, one day he gets a shot at riding the horse. He's going to take it for a test spin around the track, and he falls off. He's actually not a very good jockey, sustains an eye injury, and they send him to the hospital overnight to repair this tear in his eye. And the hospital records show that they release him the next day. Only he's still living at home with his brothers. He has two brothers and his mother. The Sirhans lived in Pasadena, and they say that Sirhan didn't return home for 2 weeks. He was at a special clinic where they were repairing the tear in his eye, while the hospital says they released him that one night. He cannot remember what happened at the shooting. He's gone for parole 15 times. He had 15 parole hearings. And each time they ask him if he's sorry for what he's done, if he has remorse. And each time he tells them he does not know what happened. He cannot remember. He doesn't remember from the very beginning when he's arrested in the kitchen and they take him into the police station. And he's very talkative, he's very chatty, but not about the event, because he says he remembers going to the ambassador. He was hoping to get lucky, quote unquote, that's what he tells them, finds this young woman who seems rather attractive, follows her around a little bit, and the next thing he remembers is being choked by a guy on a serving table, which is Rosie Grier, who's pulling the gun out from his hand. So unlike other assassins who have been paroled, like John Hinckley, who recently was paroled, and you remember he shot at Reagan, but he does kill Jim Brady, who dies, you know, a couple of years after because of the injuries he sustains. And another very interesting assassin is Dennis Sweeney, who was the assassinator of Allard Lowenstein. So going back to, you know, Allard Lowenstein, Dennis says that he is told to kill Allard by voices he hears in his head, which are coming from fillings in his teeth. Remember that? Yeah, he's getting some kind of radio signals or something. My point here is about Sirhan's injury, about people like Dennis Sweeney. There was information that came out. In fact, the New York Times, and I brought this with me here, the New York Times ran this story July 21st of 1977. I'm going to read you the headline. CIA data show 14-year project on controlling human behavior. Here's the first paragraph. I have to read it to you. According to documents acquired by the journalist John Marks under the Freedom of Information Act, the Central Intelligence Agency had been working for more than a decade on a project of experimentation on unwitting humans in pursuit of mind control procedures. Quote, to be sure, drugs were part of it, the Times report quoted Mr. Marks saying, but so are other techniques such as electric shock, radiation, ultrasonics, psychosurgery, psychology, and incapacitating agents. So if you ask me what was going on with Sirhan, I think what had happened was those 2 weeks that he was missing, he wasn't at the hospital, at least not the hospital that they took him to from the track, he had been experimented on. And his goal, the goal for him and the girl in the polka dot dress, if you remember that lady, was to create diversion in the ambassador kitchen so that whoever the real assassins were, no one was looking at them. They were all looking at this crazy guy who's got a gun, and he's shooting people, and he's shooting the ceiling and the walls, and he's shooting all over the place.
Now, you will admit that what you're saying strains a certain amount of credibility. You said in the very beginning yourself that 70 people saw him do it.
Yeah, I'm not saying he wasn't shooting at him, and certainly there was two shots in Robert that came from Sirhan's gun. It just wasn't the killing shot.
We are talking to Ronnie Cohn, a writer, a playwright, written 4 plays, and the one we're talking about now is about the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Blood in the Street. Okay, so now, Sirhan, just to be clear on this, has never said, Ronnie, that he didn't do it?
Right. He doesn't know what happened. And, you know, after they arrested him, they had a series of doctors examine him in prison. Many of them hypnotized him in an effort to get him to remember. They all said he was very easy to hypnotize. He was extremely accessible to that. And they had him do all these other things, like climb the bars in his cell and say certain things when he woke up and all this stuff. But they couldn't get him to recall that evening.
Talk to me.
And he still doesn't.
Sounds a little self-serving to those of us who are listening to this are saying, well, okay, so, you know, he's saying, I can't remember. That's a good defense. I can't remember.
Well, you know, that's why I brought up the other guys, the other assassins who get paroled.
Yeah.
Because they do say, you know, gosh, I'm really sorry I was, you know, in a bad way, or I've had some psychiatric help since then or whatever. And they've admitted it and they get, you know, paroled eventually. So it would be kind of in his best interest to say something, but he doesn't.
Now, I see that your name is Ronnie Cohen. I presume the Cohen is spelled so that we can presume you're Jewish, right?
That would be presumptuous, but yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I'm asking you this is here's a Palestinian guy who's accused of this, and there were many people who thought he did it because Bobby Kennedy was on the wrong side of that issue as far as Sirhan
Israel, right. Mm-hmm.
So, you're the playwright. The only reason, it may be presumptuous, but the only reason I raise it with you, and if it is, I apologize, but was this part of your worldview, your Weltanschauung, as you write this play?
No, not actually with this guy. But I'll tell you where it does connect with me on a more personal level is with Jack Ruby in the JFK assassination.
I want to go there, but I don't want to go there yet. So put that aside for a second. There's somebody else you mentioned, which is LBJ.
Yeah.
Now, there are people in this country who still to this day, I talk to them and say, well, he did it. He clearly did JFK, and he clearly hated the guts of Robert Kennedy, who hated his back. We knew that, or the other way, or the other way around. Has anybody ever brought that narrative into the Sirhan place?
Well, our play is called Blood in the Street. And the reason it's called Blood in the Street is it's a direct quote from Robert Kennedy, who said to, I think it was Frank Mankiewicz, that if the American people knew how my brother died, there'd be blood in the street.
Do we have any idea what that meant?
Yeah, David Talbot, you know the author David Talbot, calls Robert Kennedy America's first conspiracy nut. He obviously saw that there was a lot of things going on in the day. Don't forget, it wasn't just the Kennedys who were being assassinated. It was Medgar Evers. At any rate, so there were tons of things going on back then. And Robert Kennedy, another quote he made to an aide was, one of the first things he was going to do when he became president was reopen the assassination of his brother. So while you and I were told that Robert Kennedy, you know, after the assassination of JFK was holed up in his home, you know, despondent, he stops being the attorney general, he hides out for a while, there is also some information that says, you know, he was also already investigating the case himself. He was tracking Oswald's movements. He went even to Mexico, where Oswald had been right before the assassination, and was working on the case himself. He was, an attorney general. He said, one of the first things I'm going to do is reopen the case. If you had anything to do with that assassination of JFK, you would now have to do something about this.
Okay, so you have LBJ. You also had, Bobby Kennedy had a very contentious relationship with the FBI, didn't he?
Yes.
Hoover did not fit
Hoover,
well together.
Yes, yeah. Well, and Hoover is one of, you know, LBJ's BFFs, so to speak. They were neighbors. They had been friendly for years. LBJ uses Hoover for the Warren Commission. He's the guy that's digging up all the information. They're all kind of in the same sort of stew. You know, there is a very interesting YouTube, and you can Google this, Alan. I did it the other day just to make sure it was still there, and it is. It's 1969, CBS. LBJ is being interviewed by Walter Cronkite for the news. And they're talking about a lot of things. He's been out of office now for about a year. And Cronkite's asking him all these questions, but they get on the assassination. And LBJ, looking straight into the camera, says he believes it was a conspiracy. And Walter Cronkite looks like he might fall off his chair because, I mean, LBJ was the guy that puts the Warren Commission together, goes through all of that. It's accepted by everybody, the report. So Walter looks at him again and says, are you sure that's what you mean? And LBJ repeats it. He says, yes, I think it was part of a conspiracy. Now, we never saw that on TV because the day after, CBS makes a decision not to run it. But you can still Google it. It's on YouTube, and you can see it for yourself. He's saying that he thinks the assassination of JFK was a conspiracy.
Okay, so now, Ronnie Cohen, just to bring it all into perspective, your play is going to suggest to us when we see it, and we will, that what was really afoot here was that someone other than Sirhan orchestrated this thing and put it together, and I need to know who that someone was.
Give me another minute and I'll get to it, because I want to say one more thing about the girl in the polka dot dress. So in the kitchen, many people hear this woman, after Sirhan shoots, she yells out, "We shot him, we shot him." Do you remember that?
No.
There's about three or four witnesses who testify to this, one of whom, they're called the Bernsteins. They're an older couple. They're running out of the kitchen, but they run into a cop in the parking lot, and they tell him they heard this young woman screaming, "We got him, we got him, we shot him, we shot him." And so this cop puts out an APB on this girl in the polka dot dress. But just think about that for a second. What real assassin would make, you know, in glee, an announcement that we got the guy, you know?
Unless she was talking about "We got Sirhan."
No, because Sandy Serrano, who was the first person who heard this expression, said to her, the girl in the polka dot dress, "Who did you get?" And she said, "Senator Kennedy." So to me, Alan, what that
Do we know who
suggests,
she was, by the way? Do we ever know
No,
who
we
she...
never find her, and the
We never
APB,
find her?
Nope, we never find her, and the APB is called off. And there's a whole other side story, which we could talk about her in a second. But my theory on her is that she, too, has been manipulated and is placed in the kitchen for another diversion.
But is she the one, I'm sorry, Ronnie, but is she the one that he thought he was trailing around, Sirhan, the bloody
Yeah,
could get
they
lucky
were,
with?
Yeah, they had been noticed by many people together at the bar and having a cup of coffee together. They had seen her. She was very attractive. And so a lot of people remembered her. And in fact, the next day, there was a composite photo of her put in the L.A. papers in hopes that somebody would recognize her and come forth. But eventually, the LAPD said she was a figment of the imagination or a mass hysteria or something, and they just put her aside. And, you know, after a couple of weeks of trying to find her, forgot about it.
Now, you said there was another side story you wanted to go to. Was that it?
I don't know if we should go there because it's truly insane. But there was a very nice man named Fernando Farah, who I had the pleasure of actually knowing. He passed away last year of cancer, unfortunately. But unlike the JFK story, when you get down to the Robert Kennedy story, there's only a handful of people who were interested in it. And Fernando Farah was one of them. And he wrote a book called The Girl in the Polka Dot Dress. And the reason he was so interested in her was the day after the murder, he worked for the L.A. Sun, and he worked the police beat. So he knew all the cops, and, you know, he was always hanging around the police station. But he got contacted. He wrote the story, and he had the composite picture. And he got contacted by a guy named John Fahey, who said that he thought he knew who this girl was, and he thought he actually saw her at the Ambassador the day before when he was there on business. And so Fernando picks this guy up, and they go back to the Ambassador, and they try and sort of recreate the day that this guy, John Fahey, met the girl in the polka dot dress. She wasn't wearing the dress at the time. And he says she's kind of nuts. She's all over the place, and she's really scared. And she asks Fahey if he knows how to get a passport. She needs a passport because she wants to leave the country. And John Fahey, you know, tells her to go to the post office. He wasn't sure exactly how to get a passport in that time. And in the day, you know, in the hours that they spend together, they're talking in the coffee shop of the Ambassador. She tells him all these crazy stories, half of which he cannot believe. And the other half, she changes her tune halfway through. It's clear that she's not operating on all cylinders. But one of the things she says to him, which, again, I know this is going to sound pretty insane, but it's in Fernando's book. She says to him that she has to get out of the country. She's involved in something she's terrified of, and she's got a way out if she can get a passport. She knows the guy who runs the Flying Tigers. And the Flying Tigers was an airline back in the 50s and 60s that worked in Southeast Asia. This is sort of before there's a real Air Force, you know, in the United States. And people like the Flying Tigers were used, you know, to move troops and stuff and do things for the government. And she's met his wife, Anna Chenault, in Washington. And Anna said that her husband will take her out of the country if she gets the passport. So we all know that name, Anna Chenault, has appeared very recently as people have looking back at the Nixon years. With some trepidation, I bring it up because it could be that there is not only the LBJ connection to this, but there's another president that's connected to all of it.
And that is?
Our friend Richard Nixon.
Of course.
You know that Richard Nixon wrote a letter supporting Jack Ruby, who he called Jacob Rubenstein. He wrote a letter that Jacob Rubenstein worked for him in 1947. Congressman Nixon, on November 24th, 1947, wrote a memo about Jack Rubenstein of Chicago, who worked for him, and it's in the FBI files, which were recently declassified. So there's a lot of stuff.
Well, let's go there. You know, we have, of course, talked about Blood in the Street, which is the RFK play. But before that, there was Witness by the World, a play about the assassination of JFK. So now, obviously, one in your career has led to the other, right? I mean,
correct. Obviously. Yeah.
But immediately upon speaking, you started to talk about your fascination with Jack Ruby. Why was that?
Well, you know, I was a kid when the assassination happened. We had the day off of school the next day.
Just for perspective, how old are you now?
I'm 68.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Go ahead. Very, very young 68.
Yeah. I'm a young 77. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I was watching TV. It was black and white in my parents' bedroom because we were off from school the day after the assassination, and the whole world was watching as they led Lee Harvey Oswald out in the police station garage, and they were going to transfer him to a different jail when Ruby shoots him on live TV. I think it's the only murder ever been on live TV.
I'll never forget it as long as I live. Yeah.
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
Exactly. And so in this rabbit hole that Jane and I go down in investigating
That's your co-playwright.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Ruby was our way in. We decided we'd focus on Jack Ruby because it was so astonishing and made no sense to us, even as children, that he did it supposedly to protect Jackie Kennedy from having to go through a trial or some BS kind of
story. Where did he say that, Ronnie?
He's actually quoted on that, and it's told to him by his lawyer as he's standing in front of the magistrate who's going to want a motive. And his lawyer tells him to say that he thinks he's a hero. He's saving Jackie Kennedy from more angst and having to come back to Dallas for a trial. He just took matters in his own hands, and he thinks he's a hero. So I'm going to get to Jack Ruby in a second, but I have a couple more things that you can get on YouTube that gives me more credence, makes me feel more substantiated. And the first one is John Connolly, who, if you recall, in the assassination, also gets seriously injured. He's sharing the limo with JFK. And it's the day after, same day as Ruby shoots Oswald. He is being interviewed in the hospital. He's all wrapped up in a hospital bed. His shoulder is wrapped. His legs are wrapped. He's pretty much a mess. And a local Texas news is interviewing him in his bed, and he's explaining what happened. And he says that he was not struck by the same bullet that hit JFK. What happened was he heard the thump of the bullet that first hits Kennedy, and he turns around to see it. And then he's hit himself on the other side in his shoulder. I go through all of this because later on, he has to change his story. He has to say that, in fact, it was the same bullet because it's the magic bullet, if you remember those terms. The Warren Commission can only make sense of this story if it's the same bullet that kills Kennedy, that goes through his body and hits John Connolly in the shoulder, goes through John Connolly's shoulder, and then lodges in John Connolly's thigh, making sort of a 90-degree turn somewhere to get down into his lap. And that's one of the big points of the Warren Commission when they're talking about the forensic. But Connolly tells you right there on YouTube, you can see it yourself, that in fact he was not shot by the same bullet. It was a different bullet. So anyway, here we go back to Ruby.
So wait. What do you make of the Connolly turnaround?
Well, they got to him, obviously. They said, listen, for the sake of the American public, you know, the Warren Commission was a report that actually worked backwards from their conclusion. So LBJ in those days The American public thought this could have been, the assassination could have been the Ruskies coming in, or it was the Cubans coming in, or it was some other, you know, we were in the Cold War, some other thing that outsiders did. So LBJ wanted this very clear to be, no, no, it's a one lone nut gunman. And that was the conclusion. And the Warren Commission basically worked backwards to support that conclusion.
I want to point out that we're talking to Ronnie Cohn. She's a playwright. She's written two very interesting plays, one of them about Robert Kennedy, the other before that about JFK. If I can, Ronnie, I wanted to go back to your fascination with Ruby. Perhaps you could talk about that a little bit more for us.
Well, Jacob Rubenstein. Okay, so first of all, a guy is sort of a low-level mafia guy. He grows up in Chicago. In our play, we really go deep into his family life. He's one of eight kids. They are very poor. It's during, you know, the Depression years. He's scrambling to be in the mob. And finally, he gets sent to Dallas to run a few kind of sleazy nightclubs there. But he never really makes it into the big time. And the theory is, you know, that he was tapped to take Lee Harvey Oswald out before he can talk and tell what happened. You know, Lee Harvey Oswald, in my impression, is a patsy, not dissimilar to Sirhan, a diversion. And once he gets into jail and realizes he's been set up, he's likely to talk. So they put Jack Ruby in to take him out, and didn't seem to be too difficult if you watched him do it on television.
Well, it's extraordinary.
Sort of waltzed in. Yeah.
Well, it's extraordinary. They let everybody stand there. You know, can you imagine that being done today? It wouldn't be done.
Right, right.
Okay, so Ruby takes him out, then Ruby dies of cancer.
Right, right, right. So, good. I'm glad you made that nice segue. So, while he's in jail, he gets a visit from the people of the Warren Commission who want to interview him. And I brought along a quote of Jack Ruby, what he tells the Warren Commission, again, in the old days, meaning like five, six, oh, maybe 10 years ago, you could find this on YouTube. You can also find it in some of the data dumps that are online for assassinations of those years. But what Jack says, and I quote this, the world will never know. And you know what? Jack Ruby was not the brightest light in the chandelier. So you can even hear it in this exact quote, his lack of education. But he says, the world will never know the true facts of what occurred or my motives. The people that had so much to gain and had such an ulterior motive for putting me in the position I'm in will never let the true facts come above board to the world.
So that's the mob. That's the mob he's talking about, right? It's the mafia.
I don't know. He says, let me finish it. Gentlemen, I want to tell you the truth, but I can't tell it here. If you want a fair shake out of me, you have to take me to Washington. I tell you that a whole new form of government is going to take over the country, and I know I won't live to see you another time. So, I don't know. Does that sound like the mob that he's referring to you?
I don't know. Or, you know, Ronnie, it's very strange. I once knew a young woman, and her father was a Teamster, a very high-ranking Teamster, who told me, he's dead, I always thought it was baloney, that they had killed JFK.
Yeah.
And, of course, we knew that there was this confluence between them, the mob and the Teamsters at some point. So I thought that might be where you were going.
Well, there is a huge connection between the mob and the Teamsters, yes, but also the CIA. And that starts back with Cuba, right? Because in the old days, it was inherited actually from Eisenhower-Nixon days. They were trying to get Castro out of power. And they had all those crazy things that they were doing at the time. You remember we read about
cigars and the rest.
Yeah. And they put itchy powder or some kind of powder in his wetsuit because he liked, you know, all this crazy stuff. Well, the CIA was often tapping the mafia to execute those plans. They had a relationship.
When you say tapping, you mean calling on?
Yeah. Because they weren't allowed to do that themselves. They had to find an enforcement, you know, partner. So, yeah.
Well, there was Sam Giancana, right? And the girlfriend and all the rest of that. Right, okay.
Right. The way you can try and figure it out, at least mentally, we did this for our purposes of writing the play, was to come up with sort of three buckets. The bucket that's labeled who planned it, then who executed it, and who covered it up. So if you think about the assassination of JFK in those terms, it does help to organize your thoughts. You know, the who planned it really means, well, who had a motive to want Kennedy gone? And I'll tell you, there's a very long list. It's got a lot of people who were enemies of the Kennedys. Not only the people we're just talking about, the military and the intelligence guys, but, you know, remember, Kennedy botches the Bay of Pigs.
Sure.
At least he gets blamed for it. And after that, the military guys who were advising him thought he was a coward, thought he was maybe in cahoots with the Russians. There was some back channels in those days with Khrushchev, and Kennedy hated the CIA. He had that famous quote about splintering it into 1,000 pieces and sending it on the wind, scatter it to the wind. You know, some of these very same guys will come up later in our history at Watergate. And then there was a couple of things that most people don't know that Kennedy was trying to do vis-a-vis Vietnam. He had campaigned. He was a hawk when he campaigned against Richard Nixon in that election. But when he got to be president and he started to get the hearings and the briefings and he got to see what was really going on there, he changed his mind. And he, in fact, issued in 1963, October the 5th, a national security action, and I have the number here, it's NSAM number 263, that was going to bring the boys home from Vietnam. And they were going to start now, and it was going to be done. Everybody would be home by Christmas of 64. And when the military saw that he had made this executive action, which he was allowed to do as president, that just was another sort of nail in the coffin, if you will, because they were adamant that that was not the right path to take in Vietnam. The security action, this 263, will get rescinded when Johnson takes over. He pulls it right after the assassination. But between the, you know, the CIA, they were doing regime changes all over the world. Everybody knows about, you know, Guatemala and Latin America, South America, and some African nations where the CIA felt their president was not friendly to the West and had them removed or replaced. And that's what Robert thought had happened with his brother.
How do you know that?
So he actually made a phone call to, I think it was Richard Helms, who was running the CIA then, and said, "Did your boys do it?" And you can find a lot of that stuff out in David Talbot's book, The Brothers. It's a really interesting book about Robert and Jack. But beside those, there's a lot of other motive, people with motive. Like, a lot of people don't know about the oil guys in Texas who hated the Kennedys and thought they were these Eastern Ivy snobs. Obviously, they had...
Which is what LBJ thought, too, right?
Yes. And I was going to say they have LBJ sort of in their pocket. But again, another not well-known tax change was in place in October of 62. JFK changed the oil depletion allowance, which was a huge detriment to the oil guys. You know, the oil depletion allowance was giving them the opportunities to drill holes and do things, and in case it didn't work out, they had all these tax breaks. Mm. Well, JFK eliminated it in his new tax plan. It was yet to go into effect, but it was written. And it was like $300 million a year for these oil-producing guys. So, you know, they weren't that thrilled with the Kennedys. There were industrial families. Another little-known thing that Kennedy was doing in office was, by an executive order, he had created or wanted to create a new currency. So we were already off the gold standard by then, but Kennedy had a new currency that was not going to be backed by the Federal Reserve Bank. In fact, it was going to be silver. And that executive order, because I want you to be able to look this stuff up, is 11110, which was going to institute another currency to run alongside the currency that was currently in the marketplace.
I want to point out to everybody, we've been talking in this fascinating interview to author Ronnie Cohen. She and her partner have written a number of plays, one of which is Witnessed by the World, another is Blood in the Street, which is the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Witnessed by the World is JFK. And it is fascinating stuff to think about to this very day. Now, Ronnie, we have 6 minutes left, so we have to bring it all together.
Well, I was going to tell you, you know, who I thought executed it, but we've talked about that.
No. Who executed it?
Well, according to what I've learned, there were sharpshooters in the sewers. It was organized by the CIA. There were several teams in Dallas. And you're right, one or two of the hitmen were from Santos Traficante's mafia family. And then you had some of the CIA guys, and you had Oswald shooting from behind, from the book depository. So
you have no question that Oswald was shooting, right?
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure he was. Yeah. But again, they didn't trust him to take out the president. If you were going to do this, you would want a sharpshooter. You'd want a professional guy in there, and maybe more than one, to make sure that the job got done. So Oswald was shooting. For sure he was shooting, but he was really a distraction.
And we know that in the case of RFK, Sirhan Sirhan was shooting also. So, So your plays do not debunk either of those. They're both shooting, they're both arrested, they both take the heat. But you're saying there were guys in manholes who were doing this. It could be the mafia. It could be the mafia in conjunction with other forces. And when you mount these plays, do people say, come on now, Ronnie, you got to do better than that?
You know, there's a lot of uncertainty, I would say, by the American public on what happened back then.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
A lot of people, including, you know, we've talked about the Warren Commission, but let's not forget that there was the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 79, which disputed the findings of the Warren Commission. So if you weren't confused before then, you know, you certainly, it's easy to be confused today.
And how so? We got 4 minutes, but how so? What were the major differences between the House Committee and the Warren Commission?
They were different people. The House Committee were senators and people
from
the House.
I know. But that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, what were the differences in the way it went down, according to the House, as opposed to the Warren Commission?
Well, the conclusion was from the House that it was a conspiracy, that there were more than one shooters and there were more than one people involved. And Warren Commission placed it all on Lee Harvey Oswald. He was the lone nut gunman. But I'll tell you one thing in closing here, you know, that the cover-up is still really in place. So back in 2012, the National Archives reversed the decision they had made to put all of this out in 2013 in time for the 50th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. And a couple of years before 2013, they changed their minds. And they do unclassify a lot of information, some of it redacted. But they keep about 1,200 files from the CIA in a vault and say that they'll release them in 2017. And it was interesting for us looking at the Trump presidency to see whether he would do that or not. And he did release some, but he kept a lot still locked away. And so now we are told it will be 2023 when the final reports are given to the public. You know, if Woodward and Bernstein, who come on the scene at Watergate in the 70s, if they had been back in the assassination period back then, because the media did very little to push against any of these, you know, investigations and conclusions. They bought them, sort of, and they aired them, as I mentioned before, even the CBS thing with Walter Cronkite and LBJ. But if Woodward and Bernstein had been around, I think we would know the truth today.
We've been talking with Ronnie Cohen, who is a playwright and who has written with her partner 4 plays. 2 of the most interesting are about, I think, and not having seen any of them, but 2 of the most interesting have to do with the death of Robert Kennedy, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, and the other, the assassination of his brother, JFK. And she is currently working on a novel about a struggling magazine publisher, gets a chance to expose the truth about the Kennedy assassinations and aftermath, called The Cover Story. And I can't wait to see it. Ronnie Cohen, thank you so much for being with us. We so appreciate it.
Thanks, Alan. It was great talking with you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.